Chapter 26. The rabbit lasted surprisingly long. Its soft and now still innards glowed wetly in the lantern light, streaks of red staining its brown fur and joining darker red streaks where blood had flowed from the top of the rough stone slab down to the cave floor. Heavy odours of rot and decay hung motionless in the rough, subterranean chamber, shot through with cracks and slick with seeping water. Pale tendrils of roots dangled lifelessly from the ceiling, water droplets clinging to their tips before losing their grip and falling into glassy, dark pools in the pockmarked floor. Years ago, the voice had led him to the crack in the rocky hill near Ten Wheel Creek, not far from his modest manor. Thickly leaved vines and a nearly impenetrable tangle of debris, washed down during a flood, had completely obscured the wide but low fissure. It took 2 days of work to clear enough of it away to allow entry, and then another day to cleverly conjure a way to conceal it again, so anyone chancing by would continue on their way. The low crack required him to stoop when coming and going, and rendered it difficult to pull game animals of any size into its depths. Once past the opening, the crack shifted and grew tall and narrow, slanting slightly but unevenly downward. Walls slick with water and slippery fungus always befouled his clothing. His increasingly frequent visits had cleared the floor of most of its slippery carpet, but he still watched his footing carefully. The chamber in which he now worked waited beyond a larger one, filled with a wide, knee-deep pool. A school of pale fish, the length of his forearm, glided through the water, dark eyes stunned by the lantern light when he crossed in and out. The fish retreated to cracks and unseen reservoirs, his echoing splashes startling them whenever he trod through the basin on his way to snuff out the life of another victim on top of the slab. The water in the walls, the pools, the drips, and the basin itself spoke to him. The voice in him brought him as a guest into its dark, lonely home. This evidence of his progress pleased him during his first visit, but the voice banned him from returning to the dark tunnels until he could crush the emotion of pride and enter stoically, devoid of self-aggrandizement or ambition. He succeeded in time. Learning to view the unimportance of everything in the world around him took years of grinding work and now formed part of his very nature. Quashing feelings of his own importance took little time by comparison. He travelled a great deal during the summers, so when he returned during the fall months, he killed regularly and casually, always careful to avoid detection. His offerings to the voice he brought to the bowels of the cave, killing them there. The small animals, like the now motionless rabbit, were easily transported in a sack. His larger prey, a dog, a pig, or an itinerant worker, he had to bludgeon into submission before he could pull them through the tight passageways. The pale fish licked up his victim's blood as he pulled them through the pool, the same way they licked his blood when he first passed through the waters, barefoot, at the voice's behest. The fish had teeth. On that first visit into what he viewed as an underground temple, he had doffed his boots and slipped his legs into the water. In panic, he had nearly dropped the lantern when the fish darted toward him. When they had nibbled on the flesh of his legs, terror gripped him, and he turned to escape, only to be forbidden by the voice. He had endured their feasting, the fish darting in and snipping away bit after bit of his skin, blood oozing into the water to be inhaled by the hungry creatures. When he could endure no more, when the crimson in the water seemed more than the fish could ingest, he had cried out in agony, and the fish retreated into their holes. Wincing, he had pulled himself out onto the bank, angling the lantern to inspect his wounds, only to find a ring of curious scars around both his ankles, patterned into what looked like a primitive language. Nothing bled, and the pain faded quickly. The voice had marked him that day. He belonged to it now. He was its servant, its priest. These thoughts of exaltation earned him his first expulsion from the sacred chambers, and it took a winter of sacrifice until he was ready to return. But when he did, he earned a greater gift. That gift would protect him and one day propel him forward into the chamber of the eternal flame. And there, as a vessel of truth, he would turn the eternal into the ephemeral, and the voice would have its victory. Carefully, he untied the rabbit's paws. He had driven four spikes into the altar rock just for the purpose of immobilizing the smaller offerings. Larger animals and men required larger stakes pounded into the ground and heavier ropes for restraint. He had learned much from his vivisections about what creatures of many varieties could endure before succumbing to death. Any fool knew where to shoot a deer to free its life from its body. Few knew how to remove tiny bits here and clamp this and cauterize that to keep it alive as a grotesque version of its former self. The voice had begun to disapprove of his experiments, seeing his budding arrogance at his skill, and he had to make more offerings and lock away more inappropriate feelings. Now that spring had come, and his work with the Aid Society plot had arrived prematurely to its conclusion, the voice had set the stage for his final act. He would, of a rarity, spend his summer at home until the call came for him to travel to Belshire. The longer he tarried, however, the more bothersome his wife, the Baroness, became. She had acquired another bird. She pampered it and fawned over it and treated it with such bizarre condescension that he could scarcely stand it. His years of training had not rubbed off on her in the least. The oddest of things endeared themselves to her, like the drapes in her drawing room, the painting of her great uncle, or even the silverware. All foolishness and idiocy. If she prized the drapes so dearly, would she be shocked when he destroyed them? He had desperately wanted to kill the bird since she first purchased it, but wouldn't do it until he was sure he could strangle the life out of it and not feel any satisfaction doing so. Kill it he would, though, and its fawning mistress too. He would do it with a blank heart and a blank eye. He would walk away from his riches and his land without a glance back or a stitch of sadness in his heart. All was vanity, all was purposeless. All was here, now, and then forgotten, in the long march of years. In the end, only the wind, water, and earth remained to claim all three impervious and independent. Light and fire were but upstart encumbrances to the world, dependent upon the more stable forces. Like parasites, fire and life must have an end. He would end them.